Good morning. Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's April 13th. Please silence all cell phones. Time is 9:03 a.m. Present today are Co-Chair Stedman. I believe Senator Olson might be online. Senator Von Imhoff could be joining us in a bit. She is excused. Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wilson, and Senator Hoffman. All right. First up is Mr. Dan Robinson, grant presentation on Alaska employment, wages, and population trends. Second item on the agenda is we're going to finish the Senate Bill 241 appropriation supplemental capital. So, Mr. Robinson, if you want to join us, and if your presentation is ready to go, please put yourself on the record and proceed. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Dan Robinson, I'm the research chief at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Research and Analysis Section. Yeah, I should have remembered that. As I hope some of you know, hopefully all of you know, we produce a lot of the economic data that you see either from us or from a lot of other sources. We have a monthly magazine where we write two or three articles a month on Alaska's economy. Look at all the data we can find, generally with a jobs focus, but not entirely. We work with AHFC on housing data, we work with the university, DEED, HSS. So we either directly produce a lot of data or are familiar with a lot of data. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a few things that I thought would be especially relevant to your work. But I would be very happy if, in addition to that, if you had questions about data, that there would be follow-up requests that I could get you any details. So, as if you would, I was going to say don't be shy about jumping in and asking for things you don't see. The other thing I wanted to mention just on this title slide, you know there's lots of uncertainty, an extraordinary amount of uncertainty right now. That almost goes without saying to anybody paying attention. But there are some things that are clear, and there is some risk, I think, in exaggerating the extent that things are destabilized. There are things that move fast and things that don't, and job numbers and population and some of the other things we'll talk about are kind of in the slower moving category. So this is what we'll cover today, some job numbers primarily with the focus on how we've done in the last few years, specific to COVID, but then we've had some other shocks too, even going back a little bit to our oil price issue, our oil kind of disruptions from 2015 forward. That's been a big shock for Alaska. And then the second item there, we'll look a little bit at GDP and personal income, because jobs, as important as they are, they don't tell us everything about an economy. GDP, how much our economy is producing. Personal income, how much Alaskans are receiving from the different sources of income. And then finally, just a few special topics that one of the co-chairs have asked for a little information on. So that's where we'll finish up. So starting here, this shows Alaska jobs seasonally adjusted, so we don't have the up and down of seasonality, which is especially high in Alaska, the most seasonal of all states by job market. But don't exaggerate even that. 15% from our low point of the year to our high point of the year. Some Alaskans think, and occasionally I'll stumble into a tourist who will say, Do you fold up shop here? Is there no Alaskan economy in the winter? Well, that's silly. It's 15%. So most of the jobs that are here are year-round. We have some high-profile seasonal jobs, tourism and seafood processing being the most specific. But leaving that aside, this chart is designed to show you roughly our economic health as measured by job growth or lack of job growth. So what you see here is the 2015 to 2018 kind of state-specific recession. You see we're just starting to come out of it in last part of 2018, 2019, COVID hits. You see kind of a hard recovery initially and then a little bit of a floundering recovery since. So leave that there. This adds some context of how the U.S. did. This indexes those same numbers to January 2011, so you can compare Alaska's economy and the U.S. economy. It's tempting to say everybody's in the same boat with COVID, and to a degree that's true. All of the states had a deep job loss because of COVID. But we didn't go into it in the same situation, and we come out of it a little bit differently. And just a little additional context not shown here. If we looked at the 80s, the 90s, the first decade of 2000, clear up until the Great Recession, Alaska would have outperformed the U.S. economy. The lines would have been reversed. Alaska's economy would have done generally better than the U.S. economy. But since, as you can see, roughly 2013, we've done less well. Our economy has underperformed relative to the U.S. economy for almost a decade now. And this chart shows that. But again, I've zoomed in a little bit here. This graph doesn't go to zero. So these changes, what the U.S. economy is 15% above what it was by jobs as the measure. 2011, Alaska is 95. Is 0.95 of what we were. So, the sky is not falling here. But do note we are not doing as well and have not for an extended period as the U.S. economy by this measure.
Mr. Robinson, we had a 20-year run, and can you remember the dates from when it began until it ended? We were averaging about a 1% growth. Didn't we run about a 20-year span there?
Chair Bishop, you may be thinking of we had an extended period where Alaska had no job loss, and we had one of the longest in the country from after our 80s recession until the Great Recession, which didn't hit us very hard. So we were unusual, and we grew through two different U.S. recessions. Which may be what you're thinking about. And the growth was it wasn't really strong. It probably averaged between 1 and 2% over that entire period.
And the reason I say that on that second piece is we had a healthy capital budget in that timeline from 2010 to 12, 13, 14 when the U.S. was in a recession.
Yeah, it would be Chair Bishop, it would be tricky to deconstruct all of the factors. Even before that, too, oil, because oil wasn't growing particularly strong through that period, but it was stable, kind of. And we had a lot in savings. So what we did not have, and this contributes to capital budget, we had the ability to have a basically stable government, a basically stable capital budget, and not the kind of disruptions that we've had since the 2015 shock and our savings being depleted, some of the big things you've been wrestling with and this building and the state as a whole.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, I think that's an understatement. I remember sitting here distinctly arguing about that Great Recession and the need to push the capital budget forward and expense some of our substantial revenue streams that was coming into the state to push us through that recession and to counter it. And arguing with the administration at the time to sit back and do nothing, we're going to have a recession like the lower 48. And it was at this table that we avoided it. And I just think it's a real understatement to miss that. So, and some of us, three of us were here at that time, three of the members, two of which were chairmen, that had that political fight. And now when you go back and look at the trends, you can hardly even find it. If you looked at the graph, you couldn't even hardly find the Great Recession in the Alaska economy in the aggregate because we took effective action to deal with it. And I think, Mr. Chairman, we're starting to see that in play again through this budget cycle where we're spending a significant amount of time using a lower price of oil, structuring our budget, and trying to increase our savings component to put the state in a position so we can respond to an economic shock, which we couldn't a year ago because our savings were completely depleted. So I just want to remind the department that some of these outcomes are policy-driven, both positive and negative.
Senator Sedman, through the chair, I'll talk about that a little bit later when we look at personal income. That debate, when and how much government should spend when an economy is weak, has been out there for a long time. During the Great Recession, interestingly, there was the stimulus spending, and we'll see more specifically related to COVID, how much the federal government in particular spent to avoid worsening a clearly bad economy, an economy kind of trying to absorb shocks. And this, the idea of government stepping in to spend more when the private sector spends less, Keynesian economics broadly, is out there, and I think widely accepted. But and another point, Senator Sedman, all of these numbers reflect to a degree policy choices. So, and it's, we get asked quite often to isolate factors, and that's difficult to do because there are always so many things going on, and everybody does tend to exaggerate the influence that they're, the things they're familiar with. But absolutely, policy choices are reflected in these numbers. And the whole counterfactual issue is problematic. What would it look like if something hadn't have happened? That's never knowable with a lot of precision.
Follow up?
Just as a reminder, Mr. Chairman, again, we had substantial disagreements with the administration at the time, and we had numerous people come before this committee and in the press making comments of how we're going to overheat the economy, and we're going to have more projects, and we're going to have jobs. And what we, in effect, did is avoid a recession in the state because we took effective action to deal with it at this table. And I recognize the federal government through their policies out of the Federal Reserve Board and their expenditures out of Congress, we're trying to alleviate it. But we can just go back to the lower 48 and see how big of a dent it was. And I think Alaska should not lose sight of that we have the financial strength if we manage our assets to avoid a lot of these economic issues that will plague the lower 48. If we have the leadership and the foresight to prepare for them and then implement a strategy to modify them.
Please continue. Next slide.
You bet. So to the question of how states have done post COVID, we looked at that in detail last summer or last fall, looking at data through the summer. And one of the patterns that we identified back then was that five states, Alaska among them, had recovered less than other states. And before I get to that, I just want to mention the look at the band of states in the West, Utah, Idaho in particular, but Montana and Arizona, and then North Carolina. They were the states that had recovered especially well. Utah and Idaho just roared out of COVID, and they were doing well before that. But the five states that had struggled, and I looked a little bit at the data in the last few days, it's still broadly true. Alaska and Hawaii, and then New Mexico, Wyoming, Louisiana. Alaska has both factors. So Alaska and Hawaii shared more disruption to their tourism industry by far than other states. You have to fly or cross international borders to get to Alaska or Hawaii. Hawaii shut things down really hard. So that's one factor. The other factor is oil, again. So you see Wyoming oil and coal and some other things. But oil took a big hit during COVID and hasn't nearly recovered since COVID. So states that depend especially on oil struggled a little bit more and continue to struggle a little more to come out of the COVID period, the COVID job losses.
Mr. Robison, the five, your Montana, Idaho, Utah, and Arizona, do you have any data why they came out faster? Is it COVID policies or, you know, you got any data?
Yeah, Chair Bishop, it's a good question. I don't believe it's COVID policies, although a few of those states had substantially less disruption. all state, and we talked about this a little bit in this article, all states took a big initial loss from COVID, whether they shut things down or voluntarily people social distance and did all the things that they did. But mostly Utah and Idaho went in to COVID performing quite well. They have lower cost of living, so there's been a lot of migration from California to those states. They have good tech sectors, both of them. They have good public universities, and there are a number of other factors, and you can never know that with a lot of precision, but those are some of the factors. And to say
the reason I asked the question is if we could take a lesson learned, and then would that be applicable here in Alaska?
Chair Bishop, that's exactly why we make these comparisons. You know, it's everybody likes a ranking, but what matters more is why. What are they doing? And it really is complicated to compare. I mean, you've probably done a little bit of this with budgets, but that is a key question, and I think that's one of the reasons, like I said, that we do this kind of work.
Please continue. Senator Stetner, I'm sorry.
Yeah, before we go on to that next slide, could you help us a little bit? I think we all understand the loss of the tourist ships and the loss of the tourism, and it's a huge impact in some of our communities, more so than others. If we were to factor out the cruise and the tour industry out of Alaska, how we would kind of look relative to the other states?
Yeah, Senator Stedman, through the chair, we would, and we do this thing in trends every month called gauges, and then we rank to states, and we would be roughly still in the bottom third because of the oil factor. And this summer will be a good test of that very question, because we expect a very big cruise ship tourism season. Labor shortages are going to affect that, but for the summer tourism, complete loss of the 2020 season and almost complete loss of 2021, I would guess we would be in the bottom third, but not in the bottom five.
Mr. Robinson, have you any conversations swirling around your shop, to expect from the Secretary of State, what we might be looking for J-1 visas this year? Because that's you know, we always had to sign those waivers down there at the department because we didn't have enough seasonal workers. Is there been any conversation? Are they going to be allowed this year?
Chair Bishop, we've always had a little bit of a hard time getting detailed data from the federal agency that controls that, because you're familiar, there's a process, the employer requests something, the Department of Labor has a process where they validate the request. But short answer is no. The slightly longer answer is employees, seafood processing companies, some of them that have been able to hire in previous years, either Alaskans or Americans, can't this summer. So the demand for that kind of visa has increased distinctly. This labor shortage issue is real, and it's not going away anytime soon, and that's one of the places that we
see
it.
Thank you. Please continue.
So shifting away from jobs a little bit, this is gross domestic product, and just as a reminder, this is the value of all the goods and services produced in Alaska. This value doesn't necessarily stay in Alaska, and oil is the most obvious example of that, but it's produced here. It's what our economy generates in value. And this is, in Bureau of Economic Analysis produces this data, this real and chain dollars, those are their terms, a little wonky. What that means here that matters is just that this is adjusted for inflation. So don't expect to see growth because inflation was a factor here. Inflation is pulled out. And what you see here most is the loss of $10, $15 billion of oil production, of value from our oil. You go back to 2013, oil was about a third of our gross domestic product. Most recently, it's about 10%. So and back to this uncertainty idea, I was going to say we're clearly going through this period where oil is being reduced as a share of our overall economy. Russia and Ukraine and some of those things raise some new questions about that. But But essentially, that's what you were seeing here, is that if you pull oil out, our GDP has been about flat over this period. So, and that's not terribly impressive either. But oil is the real reason for the decline in our GDP data over this decade.
And that reason is because it's our most valuable export commodity?
By far. Okay. By far. And that's been true for a long time. This 10% gets interesting because you can imagine a future with alternatives and other things where mining and some other things start to rival oil. But that's out a little bit farther.
Senator Studman.
Yes, I got a couple questions on this one. I don't know what chained dollars are. You can help me with in the public at home. A lot of people won't probably know what chain dollars are. I haven't seen that term in all the finances books I've looked at. So,
sure.
Can you help me with that?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I don't love it either. It's a BEA distinct term. It means something fairly technical, but and I used it so that people would know which BEA data set I was using. But in essence, it just means adjusted for inflation. I'll leave it at that. Inflation pulled out. So
it's the method of adjusting real dollar amounts for inflation over time to allow conversion figures from different years to all things being equal across this slide deck.
I got my question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I thought I could understand the dollars, and it looks like the chairman was prepared for the question, sneaking up on me.
Once in 2 years, even a blind hog can find an acorn once in a while.
So, I think it'd be nice to restate this chart and add, several states that you think we should be compared to, and look at the compounded effects of the GDP growth, because some of the charts I've seen lately is, the other states in comparison slowly move forward. Well, we're going basically sideways or down a little bit. And when you take it over several years, it's a huge gap that develops. And so could you do that for us? And you could use 2010, it's as good as any other year to start with.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, happy to do that. And what I think, you tell me if this is what you're thinking. I'm thinking of some oil states in particular and then some non-oil states. It gets messy fast. I did it initially with U.S., to show that the U.S., like with job numbers, the GDP has grown. There's a different pattern for the U.S. economy than the Alaskan economy over this period.
Yeah, yes, and in a compounded rate, geometric. So you're starting everybody at 100 or 1,000, whatever you want to. So everybody starts at the same because the scale is hugely different between us and Idaho and California or whatever.
That's right. We'll index it so that it's comparable. Yep,
yes,
we'll do
that.
If you
could do that, that would be appreciated. And the reason I'm asking for that, I think we shouldn't lose sight that a lot of other states are moving ahead of us, inching along, but over GDP-wise, but over several years, and here a decade and a couple of years, it's a huge difference. And I just don't want Alaska getting way behind and having us sit here at the table thinking we're just treading water. I think we're actually going backwards relative to most other states.
Senator Stedman, would there be any merit in having isolating that in two different categories, one for the energy-producing states where we're more having common, and then everybody else? And then having two slides to his question?
Senator Bishop, I think it would, and the U.S. also would be a good comparison. So we'll do a handful of small states are, I think, especially important for us to compare ourselves to. North Dakota, Wyoming, small resource-based states, New Mexico, and then occasionally Texas is interesting because very, very important oil industry, but also enough other things going on that they absorb shocks, and a lot of that's just a hugely different population base. So, but that's we'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Yep. Please continue.
Moving now to personal income. So, just reiterating what I mentioned at the beginning, this is the amount that Alaskans receive. So not the amount that we produce. This is the amount of payments from three primary sources. The biggest is work. So, and that's a job where you get a paycheck, that's self-employment. That's about two-thirds of the personal income that normally comes into a state. Another slice is called dividends, interest, and rent. So if you're a landlord or if you're a day trader or lots of things, dividends, interest, and rent. And then most relevant to what I'm going to show you today, there's something called personal current transfer or transfer receipts. So payments from government for which the recipient did no current work. So that's Social Security, that's unemployment insurance, that's the permanent fund dividend is in that category. It's not categorized as dividends, interest, and rent. It's a payment from government for which the recipient did no current work. So, and that matters here a little bit, less than other things, but I just wanted to make that distinction because the dividends, interest, and rent suggests PFDs would be there. They're not. They're in this transfer payment category. So with that little bit of probably excessive background, notice here something that's really unusual. We go through this massive economic shock, and personal income goes way up. That's not how it normally works. Normally, and over the 2015 to 2018 period, we had I hear rustling behind me. I think it's the safety vests, but it's kids. How can you compete with kids?
Senator Steadman.
Mr. Chairman, it's nice to see the youth in Alaska showing up to listen to an economic presentation.
Yeah. I just hope the state fire marshal don't come by right now.
Well, I'll continue, but except if you're a little bit distracted, and we'll be glad to go over anything more. Normally during a recession, normally during a shock, personal income goes down because we lose wages. What happened here, and Senator Steadman touched on this with the Great Recession and some of Alaska's spending during periods of private sector economic weakness, was the federal government in particular stepped up, that suggests a value judgment. They made the policy call to spend a lot of money to conceptually or philosophically avoid making things worse. And specifically, we're talking about foreclosures, evictions, student loan default, even job loss and population displacement. That idea has kind of won the day for the last two big recessions. So we go from, and this is a total, this is not a per capita, so total, and I was, when I was putting this together, I thought this group unusually understands billions more than the average person. So when you see 45 billion up to 48 billion, a $3 billion increase, and these are annual, even though it's presented as quarterly data, they're annualized. So that represents a quarter of personal income, but very large increases in personal income over this period. And then I'll explain a little bit more in another chart where the origin of that was.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What sort of jobs do you see, I guess with all these kids here, what sort of jobs do you see really growing and the state really needing to fill in the next, say, 20 to 30 years?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, short term, all of them. There is this labor shortage issue. Longer term, we do every 2 years a occupational and industry projections. So, and we'll have the next round out this fall. But things are changing fast, but occupations tend to stick around but get changed. So, for example, a lawyer does a lot of things now that it's still legal work, but it's different legal work in terms of technology, how many legal secretaries there are. The fundamentals don't, one thing we've noticed, don't tend to change very fast. If you're getting at what industries are emerging, that's kind of a different question, and technology has sped up some existing changes. Alternative energy, obviously, technology, But I'll stop there. I'm not sure if that gets at your question.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, we've got all this federal money coming in, and we keep hearing there's this job shortage. And I guess where should Alaskans be focused on looking in terms of good-paying jobs with good benefits for the next 10, 20, 30 years? Where are we going to see the biggest boom? And where do we need people to sort of, if we were to encourage them to focus on a good-paying job that is really going to be a need in the next 10, 20, 30 years, where might you steer them?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, one ending note, when I talk about that question, I steer people to all of these resources we produce, education required, employment or wages, projected growth, all those things are important. But and partly because of the kids who are here, one of the things I say is don't steer a kid who's passionate about anything away from that thing, right? We're not a command economy. We don't tell kids we need X number of accountants, go become an accountant. Somebody who's really good at almost anything can make good money. So broadly, if the question, I think more, the way to start that is to figure out what a kid's passionate about, and not just a kid, adults too. That's part of the message of this labor shortage. Employers, to keep good employees, are going to have to do a better job at making them understand they're valuable, and you know, lots of soft fuzzy stuff. But part of what's happened from COVID, and this gets exaggerated a little bit, people want to do work that they care about, and so thinking of kids beginning that journey, I think that's the place to start. What do you care about? And then let's talk about some of the possibilities.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, would you allow the chairman just a little bit of latitude?
Sure.
Which one of you students would like to come up and put your name on the record and testify and tell me and tell the committee what you want to do for a career? Okay? So do you understand the question? So I'm going to pick two people. I'm going to pick the gentleman with that's really raising his hand up with the white shirt and the black tie to come forward. And I'm going to pick the young lady, so we've got equal opportunity in employment, in the second row that has her hand up reaching to the moon. Okay, both of you come up, and you're going to put yourselves on the record. So I want to... So speak into the microphone and tell us your name, what grade you're in, and where you're from, and we'll start with the young lady first.
Hi, my name is Brielle Glanville, and I'm from Palmer, Alaska.
Okay, and so you heard the question. So what do you want to do for a living after you get out of school?
What I want to do is I want to go to college, and then I want to get an art degree, and then I want to become a cool, smooth college art teacher.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you. Sir?
My name is Jack Kane. I'm from Palmer, Alaska, and I'm in sixth grade.
And what would you like to do for a career when you leave high school?
I think I want to go to trade school and learn how to be a welder and weld for a living.
Very good. Thank you. Let's give them a round. Okay, you can go back to your seats and we'll continue with our presentation. So, we just myth-busted something right there, committee. Us adults have, in my tenure at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and in my years of in the trades teaching, running an apprenticeship program, a lot of adults say kids don't know what they want to do today. Lawmakers say they don't know, you know, what kids want to do today. They're not focused. Well, we just got two right there. We picked random out of the audience. And they already know at fifth and sixth grade what their career field is going to be when they graduate. So good on you. All right, Mr. Robson, please continue.
Thank you, Chair Bishop. And kind of to that point a little bit, this labor shortage, one of the was at the infrastructure event in Anchorage the last couple of days, and I think my minor role was to say this labor shortage issue is real. One of the tools, I think, to get at that is to get information and ideas, maybe, but start talking to kids at this age about what you just did. What do they want to do? And getting them some exposure, a little older than this probably, to actual workplaces. So you go find out what it's like to be a welder. And part of that is because most of what people choose for careers is based on what they know. Do they know somebody, a family member, a neighbor, somebody else who did that thing? So, and that means it's a fairly narrow range of choices sometimes. But to the extent we help kids and adults to see what the opportunities are, there are always more possibilities than we know. And I hope that's one of the things we help a little bit with, to say, with this degree or with this interest, you can do these kinds of jobs. So I'm thrilled with that diversion.
Thank you. And this morning's presentation will dovetail in nicely with this afternoon's presentation on workforce development needs, et cetera. So next slide.
A little more detail on this personal current transfer receipts. What you see here is the extent that mostly federal money flowed to Alaskans during the COVID period. $5 billion in that brief period before the pandemic hit, and then that first quarter. And then we see another spike in quarter one. And remember, this is a lot of things. This is payroll protection. This is child care credit. This is unemployment insurance benefits. This is, I'm trying to think of the things that went up. Social Security's in there, all the standard things are in there, but there was a lot of spending to keep the economy from spinning downwards. But do note it's Alaskans received more money in income during the COVID and still are receiving more money than they did pre-COVID. That's odd. But it's important to understand in terms of, and distribution really matters here, but it's important to understand in terms of how much Alaskans in aggregate have lost. They haven't. They've gained over this period. Again, that stretches our imagination a little bit. So moving into these special topics, this first one is the actuarial health of our unemployment insurance trust fund. You know that system got used heavily during the pandemic and in some new ways, including getting unemployment insurance benefits to gig workers and some things like that. Work search requirements were temporarily suspended. Remember, to get unemployment insurance, you have to be actively seeking work normally. But during the pandemic, for understandable reasons, those work searches were suspended. Our office, and in particular Lennon Weller, does the actuarial work. And there are important policy questions about unemployment insurance. Who gets it? How much you get? How long you get it? That's not our role. But our role is to perform this actuarial function. And all states do this a little bit differently. But Alaska can be very proud of how actuarially sound this system is and has been over its since the 80s, when David Teal, a name you're familiar with, designed this, what we're currently using. Most states during the Great Recession went bankrupt. Their funds went below zero. They had to borrow from the feds. There were borrowing costs. There were administrative hassles. Alaska went nowhere near bankrupt. And then similarly, during this period, we had a big deduction from the system. And just to orient ourselves a little bit, the green lines, that's the, by statute, that's the solvency target range. It doesn't matter that we move out of that range periodically, especially on the low side. It's designed that way, and then you build back to that range. But I'm glad you asked about this. I'm glad to be able to say Alaska's this function has this government, this important government system is actuarially very healthy. So
Mr. Robinson, I might be dated, but I know you wrote the article, but it's been a while since I read it. During this COVID period, when we had 75,000 people exit the workforce, wasn't it something like one-third of those people didn't draw UI benefits?
Yes, Chair Bishop, it was one of the red herrings a little bit. The reason employers can't hire because there are all these people sitting home collecting unemployment insurance benefits. And that wasn't an irrational idea when the feds were adding $600 to the weekly benefit amount. Plenty of people were making more briefly than they made during their work on unemployment insurance. They were making $970 plus some supplemental options a week. And that's real money. Normally Alaska's maximum weekly benefit amount is $370. So but that question was important. This study that you mentioned that we just did found that of the 75,000 workers who aren't working in third quarter 2021, for different reasons, only about a third of them filed for unemployment insurance ever. So to what that says, among other things, is that is not and probably was not ever the major factor in missing workers. So
thank you for that. Please continue.
So moving on to another topic that was requested, I mentioned that we do some contract work, some regular work. We've done this for a long time. For AHFC, we do a lender's survey to see how much lending is going out for housing, and we do a rental survey to see how much people are paying in rent, vacancy rates, and a couple of other things. But housing, as I say at the top, prices are up. Inventories are down, interest rates are low, but we know where they're headed. So like a lot of things, the housing market is in a state of flux. And the kind of increases you could find, if we Google this, nationally bigger examples of housing price increases and lower inventory. There's a lot of wild stuff going on. Some of that's specific to certain markets. But something real is happening with housing. Both on prices and inventory, and it's not sustainable. At some point, people can't afford houses anymore. As interest rates rise, housing becomes less affordable. For now, we do something called the Affordability Index that compares wages and average mortgage prices. And Alaska housing remains fairly affordable. For Juneau, just one example here, and I'll show Anchorage and Mattsu, but you can see the example of the price increase for Juneau. I hear another.
We'll take a brief at ease while we clear the room. Back on the records, Mr. Robinson, please continue.
Yes, so this, thank you, Chair Bishop, this just shows, and it's more an example than to get really, to be very, very useful as a broad statement, but you see here over a two-year period, the average loan, this is loan, there are other ways to buy houses, but most people have to borrow money, went up by from 345 to 414. We look at Anchorage, we see a similar large increase. And then Mattsu, which has long had some of the most affordable housing in the state, also saw a very large numerical and percentage increase in average loan finance for a house.
Senator Wilson and Senator Steadman, questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering here, as we talk about some of the housing markets in flux and the prices of real estate, How will the sort of the work from home shift affect the real estate market, both sort of domestic and commercial markets?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, we don't know yet, but and I'll throw in if commercial real estate as well. That in some cities, commercial downtown real estate in particular, there's some issues with if people are working from home, you don't need to do that. But what I think we're seeing is that some of that expectation of change was overblown. That you know, and we tend to do that. We think everybody's going to work from home now all the time. And then we think, well, I don't like working from home. So there was a surge of lots of people working from home. There's been a return to work of most people, not all people. Plenty of people are going to work from home indefinitely, or they discover they want to, and they're going to insist that they be able to. So again, a little bit of a long answer to say we don't know, but I don't think it'll be a major disruptive factor.
Thanks. Senator Stubman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make one quick point. I just, looking at Juneau and Mat-Su, there's about a $100,000 spread in 19, another $100,000 more for Juneau over Mat-Su. And then, even though Mat-Su's, you know, grew like 26% in price, there's still about a $100,000 difference. I find that's kind of interesting. Because we all know Mat-Su's the growth area of the state.
And need more money.
Right. And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that. But what I'd like you to do, if you could help me a little bit, you know, we've got a housing crisis or significant issue all across the state, lack of housing, homeless. And we're struggling with that here, probably will be over the next couple of years, how we're going to implement some strategies that alleviate that or try to. But then, in like when we have, like for example, in Sitka, you've got a $350 million hospital expansion in a small town of 9,000 people, a little less than 9,000 people. And there's probably, and I think they're going to add another 100 or so building units, at least 80 plus building units, housing units, to try to keep the pressure off of the housing price increases. But I was wondering if you could add to this mix here, Ketchikan and Sitka and maybe a few other communities around the state that you pick. I just want to try to look at the housing affordability index to this homeless issue that we struggle with, because I would expect with these price movements we're moving more people out of the market for being able to afford a home. And I've noticed in my district over the last decade or so, there seems to be more people doubling up in housing, and then there seems to be, you know, the housing, lack of housing, or the homeless issue expanding. So if you could maybe help us with some of that data, it would be, I think, beneficial to the committee members as we deal with the homeless issue here at the table, and also try to keep an eye on affordability of housing for the citizens around the state.
And if you would, I think, Dan, maybe just incorporate the census areas in the state and pick a hub community out of that area to go along with Senator Stebbins. So then we've got a good cross-section of the state as we're looking at this new policy that Senator Stebbins is talking about.
Senator Stebbins, through the chair, and Chair Bishop, we'll do that. We're right in the middle of, recently finished up this spring rental survey. So something else I'll raise related to that is, and we didn't see it last year, I expect we will see it this year, rental costs are going up and vacancy rates are going down. So this housing shortage, so you know, you think, well, you can't buy a house, rent, but at some point you can't rent either. This shortage of housing is a real problem. It comes up often, interestingly, and the hospital example is an interesting one. If you've got this big new, and Fairbanks, the military expansion is another one, you've got this big economic boom coming to your state, but the workers can't find places to live. That's a long been a factor in rural Alaska, teachers in rural Alaska in particular, finding housing. But now other parts of the state are seeing what that looks like when you can't bring people to a place because they can't afford to either buy or rent a house there. And the reasons are complicated and not entirely known. And I mean, supply chain is a new factor, inflation. So that's another problem that's going to get worse before it gets better.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Well, I'd just like to add to that comment. I'm glad you brought that up. I think that was definitely as significant as the housing shortage is the rental issue. But I've had numerous employers meet with me over the last 9 months talking about trying to expand their business or service their workload along the coast and other areas. And they could, when they do find employees to go to a particular community, they have a very difficult time finding housing for them, to the point where the companies have come in and actually bought housing in the communities so their employee would have some place to live. So it's broadly across the state, and particularly along the coast. And I would go clear from Dutch Harbor to Dixon Entrance. I mean, that's the broadness of the employers that have come in and brought that concern to our attention.
And Senator Stedman, that Alaska has some challenges too with the seasonality of workers. We need housing temporarily for workers. And then Sitka's interesting because we've got some, Alaska's spectacularly beautiful. So we've got housing prices that go up partly because we've got people from other parts of the country, other parts of the state that buy up the existing housing. So that has an effect on the housing market as well.
Senator Wilson, question. I'd just like to, one last thing just on this real quick, and we got three more slides and they're all on the same topic by region. We'll probably blow through those pretty quick. I would like to be done by 10, but this housing issue is real and the rental issue is real. And I'd just like to throw out a one point, and my numbers are really rough, but just pick the Juneau right now, $414,000 for a single family home. What's the mortgage payment on that? $2,500 a month. Who's making $2,500 a week to make the first month's payment? That was my dad's rule of thumb. When you buy a house on what you can afford with your first paycheck out of the month, and I think it just shines a light and exasperates the problem. We got a lot of workers that are range 14 and 15s that are working at least two jobs in this town to make ends meet. So, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Directly associated with those two items of rental and home ownership is the main underlier, which is the availability of land. You know, you look at Anchorage, there's very little land that's available for development, which starts to rise the cost. But I believe that your department should look at the availability of developable land in areas that is causing the housing shortage.
And Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the reason Mat-Su has grown as much as it has, if you have to isolate one, is inexpensive housing and land availability, and Anchorage's lack of land availability, and Mat-Su's proximity to Anchorage where the jobs are. So nowhere in Alaska, almost nowhere major, has more affordable housing than the Mat-Su worker who has an Anchorage job. So that's to your point, land availability really matters. It's true in Juneau, coastal Alaska, lots of parts, but Mat-Su is an interesting exception. And what does that do? That generates growth for decades in Mat-Su because of housing primarily.
Please continue. We're at 5 minutes left.
So, and I think this is the last or second to last slide. Just population, we have the state's demographics task, and here too, lots going on. The census was completed. I won't read this. To the last point, the bottom bullet, overall Alaska state population. So we've talked, and I do have one more slide I remember, about negative net migration. For 9 years in a row, more people have left Alaska than have come here. because of natural increase means the number of people born minus the number of people died, we've generally compensated for the migration losses with that. So Alaska's population has been generally flat to stable over that period that we're talking about. Mat-Su is the distinct standout. But there, too, growth has slowed over this period where our economy hasn't done terribly well. And over this last 10-year decade, or 10-year from the last census. And then this is just the data.
Senator Wilson did have a question on that slide, I believe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And based on your last statement, last bullet here, do you feel that the state should put a little bit more resources and development into that area of recent growth of the Mat-Su?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, that is entirely your call and this body's call and has little to do with the work we do.
Good answer. I just like to remind my committee members, research and analysis, we always kept a hands-off approach on the policy and the politics. They just give us the numbers.
Senator Chair, I appreciate you saying that because it's I hope, part of our value. Trends doesn't change from administration to administration. The numbers don't change. We don't talk about things that aren't ours to talk about. And administrations have five or six that I've worked with have all understood that. Sometimes voices are raised, but not usually. And then this last slide, I just wanted to mention, if we had to choose one thing that says, is Alaska desirable compared to the other states, this says we're not doing terribly well by that measure. 9 straight years, more people want to leave Alaska than want to move to Alaska. So that, I hope, gets our attention. And just a reminder, it's not primarily because more people are leaving. It's primarily because fewer people are coming. And that, again, goes back to oil, but also some of the challenges that you've dealt with around this table with instability, capital budgets. We've talked about some of those things.
Just an editorial comment on mine and mine alone, and it's anecdotal, but if you'll leave that last slide up.
You bet.
I talked about it briefly, and Senator Stedman reminds me sometimes I need to finish my thought process from time to time. But the analogy I was making on the housing and the affordability was getting back to workers' wages. Alaska is no longer the premier state in the nation for wages. You can, and there's a reason I believe these people are moving, because you can go south and you can go just as close as Washington State and in my trade make $10 an hour more for the same trade in Washington, where electricity is a lot cheaper than 25 cents a kilowatt in Fairbanks. $10 an hour more in Washington than you can in Alaska. Our wages have not kept up here. That's my editorial comments. So thank you. Any
sure.
Further questions? Seeing none, great presentation as always. You got some action items there from Senator Stedman, myself, and Senator Hoffman. So thank you. We will take a brief at ease while we change up presenters. All right, good morning. We're back on the record. Next up, we're going to finish our slides from a week ago, and that's Senate Bill 241, Appropriations Supplemental Capital Infrastructure Bill. Mr. Baker, if you'd bring yourself up, and Mr. Steiniger, and you guys can figure out who's sitting in the middle and who isn't, or I don't know, Senator Stebbins over the, it's all right, we leave them like that. Table's balanced out, you know, unless we want to bring Rob Carpenter up and put him in the middle, but we'll wait. Okay, that's good. So we're going to finish, and we're going to start on pick back up on page 7, everyone, and we'll go from there. The floor is yours, and we'll stop at each slide to see if there's questions.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Miles Baker, Infrastructure Investment Coordinator in the Office of the Governor.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Steinger, Director, Office of Management and Budget.
So, Mr. Chairman, just picking up on slide 7, so this was a slide that shows for the bill before you, SB 241, the way of presenting it in sort of categories, and I think the way to think about this is from the, I guess, least discretionary to the most discretionary. It's obviously all discretionary to the legislature, but the stuff at the top, which is the bulk of the bill, $950 million, and where the bulk of the GF, 70% of the UGF is in the federal programs, the standard federal programs that have been reauthorized. There are a few new programs in there that we can address, but those are the things that we would expect to have gotten over the next 5 years regardless, and what the match requirement is. The next, and we will be going through each of these pots. The next is areas where the governor felt a little bit more state support, not match specifically, but some additional UGF in areas that those programs we could plus up and add more benefit to the state. Critical minerals mapping is a good example of that. The third category, since we started developing the infrastructure bill, Congress passed the FY22 federal appropriation cycle, and earmarks, congressionally designated spending, are back and acceptable in Washington, and there were a number for Alaska. We can provide you that list if you haven't seen it, but only two of those required some additional authority, and the governor, again, we will get into this, the governor wanted to match one of those dollar for dollar on the public safety housing program that AHFC runs. The next two categories, the infrastructure coordination and implementation, as we've developed this bill and recognized that there's a lot more work to be done, it's going to be an ongoing effort, both at the state level, coordinating with local governments, coordinating with tribes, and so we've put money forward both for the governor's office and two grants, one to AFN for their navigator program and one to AML to assist with those efforts. And then the last category, which I'd say is the most sort of policy subjective, but we have identified four large areas. They're all in the Department of Energy that we think are large enough opportunities and unique enough that Alaska should be competitive that are worth putting some UGF into exploring and pursuing those. So we can talk about those in more detail as well.
Committee members, I'd like to remind everyone, we passed out at the last meeting, we've got like 17 people online for lifelines, and we had these passed out who they were by agency and their name, so you might want to pull that back out on your sheet of your file for reference if you have questions of those particular agencies.
Mr. Chairman, the individuals may have changed a little bit from last week, but hopefully we do have people online for questions.
Thank you.
So I'd like to now just go through, start going through that first category, which is the group of federal programs. And just find my notes here. The first is the in the Department of Commerce. We have money in there to establish a broadband office. Broadband is one of the biggest, probably, I guess, game-changing new investments in this infrastructure bill, and all states will be required to have a broadband office to coordinate the planning effort, and we expect to receive a minimum of, every state's going to get a minimum of $100,000, $100 million. 5% of the funding we get can be used on administration. And there's two different programs. There's another program that we expect to get another $1 million of federal planning money. So you see that there, and then the CIP off of that capital appropriation for the three positions we're proposing in the broadband office. The other piece in commerce is there is a tremendous amount of money which we'll see coming into through the EPA water programs, and commerce through the RUBA program does support an outreach to support that program, so that's the increment there. Under AOGCC, through the Department of Interior, there is a large new initiative for plugging of orphaned oil and gas wells. There's three different programs, one's for state and private land, one's for federal land, and one's for tribal land. The program that's been noticed and announced is the one for state and private land. That's where the bulk of the federal money is, and AOGCC is the lead for that. They're the required lead. All of the national equivalents of AOGCC have been working on this for quite some time. We've put in the RFI, we've gotten the notice, and so there's 12 known oil and gas wells on state land, and this is the first tranche of money we expect to get. AOGCC won't be doing that work themselves. They'll contract out, they'll work with DEC, DNR, RSA, and likely private contractors to do that work.
Okay, Mr. Baker, before I go to Senator Wilikowski, he does have a question. If you would keynote from here forward in the presentation, what's operating, what's capital on these requests, and also when we're, let's just take AOGCC's $32,341,000 Fed. Is that 5-year money, 1-year money? And if you could keynote that for us as we're going through, that would be of interest. Sure. Senator Wilikowski.
Is there a requirement that when wells are abandoned that the whoever drilled the well plug them, remediate them, and restore them?
AOGCC, are you, let's see. Let me see who's on the line.
Jeremy Price?
I don't know. Mr. Price, are you online?
He may not be.
Mr. Price from AOGCC, are you online? I do not see him, Senator Wilikowski. Did you want to take a stab at it, or?
Sure. I can take a stab at that, Mr. Chairman, and we can get back to Senator Wilikowski. There is requirement for them to do that, and of course those requirements over the years have changed and gotten much more rigid. So some of these wells are from various time periods, and so some have been plugged but not to the standard that we would require today. Some of them were plugged long enough ago that the adjacent lands are still not properly remediated, so it's sort of all over the map, if you will.
Follow up?
Yeah. Would it be possible to get a list of the wells that are being proposed to be plugged, remediated, and restored, and why the state is assuming the responsibility with those federal dollars instead of the group that drilled those wells?
And along with his question, how many will this monies clear the deck on the abandoned wells? Meaning, will it finally bring closure to all the abandoned wells?
Mr. Chairman, when the notice came out for this, the AOGCC put in a response, and part of the response was what were the cost, the known cost, the estimate to plug the wells that are on state land, and that cost was $32 million. We expect this is just the first tranche, so if those costs increase, there's potential that we can get the additional money to fill that over the next couple of years for that program. But the allocation was based on our best estimate of what the cost was to plug those. Obviously, we want to, and this is a FY22 supplemental, because we need to get out overhead as soon as we can this spring before the alders come up and really look at those well sites and make sure that we've got the best estimate on what that's going to cost.
Follow-up?
And on this project, and I guess the other ones, but this one in particular, since it's in front of us, is this bid out by competitive bid process to get someone to come in and plug, remediate, and restore?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that's the expectation. AOGCC is the sort of official receipt entity for the state and their counterparts in other states. The national organization that has been working on this for quite some time is the national organization of all the different AOGCC equivalents. And so, but they will be contracting that out and working with DNR and DEC on their portions of this work.
Follow up?
On the broadband office, $6.5 million, three permanent full-time employees, which I assume is several hundred thousand dollars. Where does the rest of the money go? Is that for studies? What is that for?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So this is the first tranche of, we're asking for the federal receipt authority of what we expect to get at a minimum in the first tranche of planning money that's available, and then the 513 is the CIP that would pay for the positions. There is a tremendous amount of work that will be required in order to get this initial planning money. We have to file a notice of intent to participate in the program, but it's a fairly technical document that will have some early indications of the type of plan, the type of work, what needs to be involved. And then once we get this initial planning money, which should be fairly quick after filing the notice of intent, then we have to develop a five-year plan that will involve setting up regional advisory groups, getting public input, working with the national agencies are going to require, even though some of the money comes through tribal, some of it comes through USDA. The expectation and the word we're getting is that they're going to want the state's five-year plan, which is a fairly detailed document, technical document, to be completed. And so that's what we expect this money to be used for both funding these positions, possibly bringing in technical expertise, having those planning events, putting together the information we're going to need.
Sure.
Please continue.
You know what would be helpful to me anyway? I don't know if you have it there, but as you go through, we have this book which has more detailed information. I don't know if you have the page numbers linked up. That would be really helpful to me and probably answer a lot of my questions if you would reference the page number of the appropriation request, if you have it.
I think
in our book here.
Do you have page numbers? I certainly can do the project number. I'm not sure how it's coordinated in your book, but we can do our best to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Nobody from Commerce is online to answer any questions, so I just want to put it on the record. If they're listening, hopefully, if not, my office will follow up for the committee. But I had a question on the Rural Utility Business Advisor, RUBA, is the acronym. You know, I'd like to know how many employees they have in there. We're looking to, you're looking to plus up two more permanent full-time positions, and I want to make sure that RUBA's connecting with the USDA. They also have another $2 billion pot of money for rural utility, electrification, water, and broadband. Again, I'm wanting to make sure we as policymakers and you as the state access every federal dollar we can to make sure that we get running water in rural Alaska and not the type that Senator Hoffman references to running with it with a 5-gallon bucket. Thank you. Please continue. Oh, Senator Stedman, go ahead.
On the slide, are we done with the slide? I got a question on the bottom.
Me too.
So we can go through these other items or move to the next slide.
We're on AEA at this point.
Okay, I'll wait till we go through the whole slide.
So in the next category, Mr. Chairman, Alaska Energy Authority, there's quite a bit of money in the bill for energy efficiency. AEA has in the normal capital budget every year, they put forward sort of a catch-all for the various grants and programs that they manage. There was funding for all four of those sub-bullets listed, the state energy program. There's a new energy auditor program, an energy efficiency revolving loan program. And so this is the just under $4 million federal receipt authority that we anticipate they would get in the next fiscal year for those programs.
Excuse me, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a large sum of money, Mr. Baker, $3 million. The last time we had a spike in oil prices in the state of Alaska had millions of dollars. We initiated the weatherization program, and as I recall, we spent maybe $500 million on weatherization compared to this $3 million that is just Fed money. And I know in talking to the Housing Authority, there are thousands of homes that still need weatherization. And I know the other body has energy money that is intended, $1,300 per individual, and I think the governor said that he's supportive of that program, but there is no way to link those dollars to actually being spent on energy, particularly in rural Alaska. And that sum is remarkably close to the amount that we spent, you know, $500-600 million on weatherization. But the good thing about the weatherization program that we spent saved individuals from $200 to $500 a month. You multiply that time over a year, and then you multiply that toward the life of that home. We're talking millions of dollars that are being saved and reducing the energy costs of individual people in Alaska. That, and then their income that they have is disposable income. Is saved, and they could use that in many other areas. So I'm wondering, has the administration looked at assisting Alaskans in that endeavor that would potentially save millions and millions of dollars in energy costs for people that get their homes weatherized? Because I think that I may offer an amendment to this bill to include general funds for weatherization So that the program, we wrote the program at this table and we passed the legislation. And I think you were working for Senator Stedman at the time. But of all the programs in the state of Alaska, I think this can is at the top one or two programs that people of Alaska said did tremendous things for Alaskans in reducing their energy costs. So what is the administration looking at as you, a coordinator of these things, think about trying to address a second go at weatherization programs for Alaskans to reduce their energy costs so that they can, we've just seen the charts for the last 8 years, we've seen out-migration of Alaskans on a net basis. And I believe one of the biggest factors, including the wage factor that the chairman pointed out, is the high cost of living in Alaska. For me, for you to say the large sum of $3,600,000 is large, that's laughable in my view. So what does administration say about the weatherization program and the benefits that it can offer?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, and if I use the term large, I apologize, because I would agree with you, the $4 million there for these programs is not particularly a huge amount of increase. This is for the first. The weatherization program I believe you're referring to is actually in the next. It's the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation that managed that, and I do recall those programs. There was one that was more of a grant sort of program for individual homeowners, and then there was a program that was managed more by the corporation that went out and worked on weatherization and more of the middle and lower income housing, and those were GF funded and supported. This amount, and actually we have a note on this, because when we put the bill together initially, the estimates we got from the federal bill had a I believe it was $3.5 billion supplemental, yes, for weatherization, and the early estimates were that we were going to get $35 million of that. Right before last week, before we introduced the bill, that number was reduced to $18 million of federal. But I guess I'd go back to the early, when we started the presentation last week, a couple of the guiding principles of this was the governor wanted to keep this as much as possible strictly to match, required match, to distinguish those federal programs that required match, keep our general fund spend down, and really, really limit the number, the amount of, I guess, discretionary additional GF spending. You will see, I guess the one related exception to that is then the earmark that was put in for AHFC's public, or it's the rural housing program for teachers' health and public safety. It's $2 million federal earmark, and the governor wants to match that with $2 million of UGF for public safety housing.
I have comments on that later on, too.
Okay. I don't know if Mr. Chairman, I do know we have some folks from AHFC. I don't know if they had anything to add to that.
Yeah. So Senator Hoffman?
So my question is, with this additional revenue that we have, should we as a state try to make Alaska more affordable to live in? You know, I could see the position that we want to keep the general fund to a minimum. What does that do to Alaskans? You know, we are here to service Alaskans. We are here to make Alaska more affordable. The federal government has billions of dollars. We have funds ourselves, and there are you know, in the list here, we have $80 million in general funds being spent. But the question is, should we, during these high costs of oil and additional revenue and the high cost of living in Alaska try to assist people to reduce their energy costs? Or should we give them a check for $1,300 in energy and hope that they spend it wisely? That is the question at hand. And, you know, I think as policymakers, we need to debate that question. You know, if the governor doesn't want to come forward with it, we could try to address it, and if he wants to veto it, he can veto it. But the Alaskans are hurting. I've heard from my Wasilla friends, they say Alaskans are hurting greatly because of the high cost of energy. But for us to hear that and do very little except maybe write them a check that would put, if they spent it correctly, would address their needs for 1 year, and after that the needs are still there. So from my viewpoint, we need to look at trying to address the very serious hurt that people of Alaska are feeling because of the high cost of fuel. In my region, we haven't even seen that yet because we haven't had the first barge. I would say, from all indications, we're going to see $2 to $3 increase in heating fuel on the first once the first barges land. We know that's coming. So what are we going to do? Put our heads in the sand and ignore it? Or are we going to actively try to assist people in reducing their energy costs? That's the question that I have with the administration.
Thank you. Okay. I want to go to Curtis Thayer. Mr. Thayer, are you online?
Yes, I am.
So I just got a on this last bullet, the Energy Auditor Training Program. And I'm not looking in the blue book in the backup. I'm just going off the slides. Just to ask you, is how many more auditors are you looking to stand up?
Well, the initial request on this one is $63,000. So it would stand up a partial auditor. We anticipate that additional funding will be in the later years. And this would be for commercial auditors. As opposed to residential energy auditors.
Meaning commercial property.
Correct.
Okay. And lastly, have you interfaced over the years with the cold climate housing in Fairbanks there to, you know, as far as this type of work?
Yes, sir, we have. We've coordinated with them, and then also we have a working relationship with Alaska Housing Finance, too, because some of the auditor training and that would be shared between the two agencies.
That'd be great if you guys could leverage your assets. Thank you. Mr. Baker, please continue. We got the Alaska Housing up.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on Senator Hoffman, the Alaska Housing Finance, the Weatherization Assistance Program, which is an ongoing program. It did get a supplemental. As I mentioned, we would probably be talking to you about reducing our new estimate is probably $18 million for that program, 18.4. It was 35 in our early estimate. And then there's some additional opportunities in the bill that AHFC would like to pursue in the area of energy efficiency research training. So, again, that's a $2 million federal receipt authority to allow them the opportunity to go after.
Okay, I'm going to go to Stacy Barnes with Alaska Housing Finance. Stacy, are you there?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Stacy Barnes with Alaska Housing, and I'm here with James Weedle, who's our budget director.
Thank you. Good morning. So this we started out at 35, and we lost half of that in a week. So this is for this fiscal year, this 18 that's targeted now to come to Alaska, and do you expect that to continue through the next 5 years?
For the record, James Weedle, Budget Director, Alaska Housing. Through the Chair, Senator, the money is actually expected to be with us for the next 5 years.
At 18 a year or 35 a year?
I believe in total it's $18 million.
Okay. And the second bullet here on your energy research and efficiency training, can you give me just a little bit of background is what that money is going to be used for?
Chair Bishop, at this point, we don't have specific details about what those programs would look like. We have some basic information, but we can certainly, as the information comes in, find out and get back to the committee.
Thank you. And what you just said was you don't have all the guidance from the feds. Is that what you just said?
That is correct, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Baker, seeing no further questions, please continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm on slide 9 for fish and game. I know the committee is familiar with the sport fish access and the wildlife restoration program, so the sport fish access numbers didn't, those programs were both reauthorized in this bill, but the numbers didn't go up so on the sport fish access, but the Pittman-Robertson funds, which are driven by gun and ammunition sales, those have increased substantially. So this is a supplemental for $18 million Fed, and that's a program that requires a match that comes out of the Fish and Game Fund. Those would be for wildlife restoration projects, a variety of eligible projects through that program for Fish and Game.
All right. I want to go to Fish and Game here for a second. Let me see who's online. From Fish and Game. Anybody? Jake, help. Somebody help me here. Nobody from Fish and Game. Okay, I'll let that question go for now. Next, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Restoration of Chinook salmon on the Kuskokwim and Yukon is of great importance to me. I've mentioned that several times at this table, and I've discussed this quite extensively with the chairman, and you know, the devastation to Chinook that's happening on the Kuskokwim and Yukon is happening throughout the state of Alaska. We need to step up to the plate in this area as well to try to reverse the trends. If we don't do it on the Kuskokwim and Yukon, you're going to see a complete lifestyle change. People up and down, hundreds of communities go out in the summertime and have harvested salmon and put it up and taught their children for generations. That is no longer happening in, from my discussions with the chairman, but is it possible to look at the restoration of Chinook salmon on the Kuskokwim and the Yukon, and for that matter, throughout the state of Alaska? This is a prized salmon, and I'm not saying we need to build the stocks up so that there are commercial harvest levels. I'm talking about personal use for Alaskans, for food security. We need to step up to the plate in this area as well. So is it possible? What are the intent of this these $30 million? And if they can't be utilized for restoration of our Chinook, can we get some idea from the administration to see if we can assist Alaskans on food security? Or are we limited by blinders that said we can't? We want to spend the minimum amount of money, regardless of the problems that exist in the areas that we're trying to address. So, Mr. Baker, what are this $30 million for, and can they be utilized for restoration of salmon, Chinook for Alaskans?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I believe, and we will get back to the committee, I believe this money is game, is wildlife, it's non-fish related, so it's game management, research equipment. To Senator Wolakowski, I've got page 24, 25, 26 in the capital backup. It's reference number 60594. So you see the number of the types of projects that qualify. It's support of wildlife management, so it can be infrastructure, aircraft hangar, it can be management and research, habitat enhancement, data management, shooting ranges, but I think this program is specifically for game. The Dingell Johnson program, which is sport fish access, may have more flexibility there, but we can get back to you specifically on whether salmon restoration would qualify.
Not only does salmon restoration qualify, but are we interested in recognizing the problem and stepping up to the plate? Are we going to get proposals to reverse the trend so that a whole lifestyle is written off our history books? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Please continue.
Excuse me. For the record, Neil Steinger, Office of Management and Budget. To address an earlier question from Senator Bishop regarding what is operating and capital on these slides. On the prior slide, there was the RUBA program as well as the broadband program, which were both operating. The rest of the items are part of the capital budget. Here in this slide, the next item that Mr. Baker will address, the LIHEAP program, is within the Health and Social Services operating budget, but the rest of the items here would fit into the capital budget.
Thank you, Mr. Steininger. Mr. Baker?
So under Health and Social Services, so there was a small supplemental in the LIHEAP program, so you see that represented here. Just to, for some perspective, I think in the current year, our funding for LIHEAP was around $10 million, so this is a relatively small supplemental, but we have included that. And there was also some specific tribal awards. There was about $217,000 in tribal awards that came through separately as part of the bill, but those don't come through the state. The next item is DMVA.
This is Mr. Hoffman, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the LIHEAP program, have you, you mentioned the $10 million amount, have you done any analysis of what the energy costs are going to be in rural Alaska on potentially jumping up from $4 to $6 to $7 to $8 a gallon? And will this amount of funds be adequate to assist people that are facing these increased costs?
Senator Hoffman, to the chair, I can get with the department and get back to you on that.
Looking forward to it.
On DMVA, Mr. Chairman, this is one of the new programs in the bill. It's there were two focus areas on cybersecurity, one through Homeland Security, and that's what's represented here. That will be coming through as grants to DMVA. We will be working closely initially on a state plan that would involve DOA. They'll probably get some RSA money from DMVA to work with our chief information officer on a state cybersecurity plan. This is a four-year program. This is the initial money, and then the first year. And there is a match requirement. 80% of this funding is going to have to be, once we develop a plan, 80% of the funds will be subgranted out to local and tribal governments. I would point out this is one, it's a four-year program. Most of the things in the bill were 5 year programs. This one was 4 year. And the match requirement does change each year. It starts out at 10%. Which is what's represented here, and then it goes up by 10% a year. So in the fourth year of the program, it would be at a 40% match.
Thank you. Please continue.
Great, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Steadman.
Thank you. On that item, the previous slide on the Pittman-Roberts, you know, we got $24 million, and looking over, I see there's, you know, half a million in shooting ranges. And I'd just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that we've got, as I recall, three shooting ranges around the state, one in Anchorage, one in Fairbanks, one in Juneau, that are in our budget that we subsidize every year. And if we're making substantial more funds or having substantial more funds coming in through Pittman Roberts, and part of the reason, or major reason, is the volume of ammunition being sold around the country, I think we should be looking at putting more funds in shooting ranges. I'm not saying ignore the three that we always do use, but we haven't put money in shooting ranges in years. When Senator Hoffman and myself were here at the table some 15 years ago, we spent a little bit of funds in that direction for shooting ranges outside of the three major state shooting ranges. And I think it's beneficial to for the youth in Alaska to have the opportunity to go out and learn to shoot and handle firearms, not only for safety, but for self-preservation when they're hunting and enjoying the great outdoors. So I'd just like to, you know, make note of that. I think it's the half a million is a pretty low number. I recognize there's, you know, competing uses of those funds, but I'd like to see more monies put in gun ranges, and we can even set it up with match, so it's just not, you know, cash coming out of Juneau.
I'd like to take a break at ease for a minute. I'm going to talk to the committee. Okay, we're back on the record. Senator Wilson, you got a question, sir?
I could yield first to the
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there any federal funds that were available that the state did not accept it?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, no.
What was the answer? I didn't hear.
The answer was no.
Thank you. Senator Wilson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I sort of asked this question last time in terms of why wasn't there more in terms of railroad type of infrastructure projects. For example, for energy for the Titan plant, LNG plant at the Port McKenzie, that can bring hopefully the lower the energy costs up in Fairbanks, and also using that rail, the same extension to for the Amber Alert project when that gets up and going. So just wondering a little bit more on federal funds that could be used for that, if we can get more information on that, and sort of the total number of FTEs that are needed, if those are going to be full-time, permanent for indefinite, or are these just going to be non-perm positions? Just trying to get a total number. My guesstimate right now is about 25 or so employees added. Just wondering, you know, how that's going to be funded and if that's going to be ongoing in perpetuity.
Would you like to respond now? Or
through the chair, Senator Wilson. So there's 27 total full-time positions represented here in this bill, and five non-permanent positions. So the 27 full-time positions, they're being brought on primarily in the Department of Environmental Conservation to manage the significant increase in some of their programs. A lot of those programs are, they're five-year increases in the programs out of the infrastructure bill. However, a lot of the actual activity once those projects are funded could go on for a decade. And so that's why we've chosen to add full permanent full-time positions rather than non-permanent positions. I think that's been a fairly common question in a five-year bill, why a permanent position, but those are really longer-term projects. Also, this bill really represents just the federal dollars that we have, you know, received enough information to know are coming to the state in one way or another. And so where there may be other opportunities, this is sort of speaking a little bit to Senator Wilikowski's question as well, there may be other opportunities that come up at a later date to address things like the railroad or other areas where we will have to come back and ask for additional federal authority. This represents what we know as of now and what's available as of now.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Baker, did you have anything to add to that?
I would just add to Senator Wilson's question through the chair. So the railroad, I would generally in this federal bill, there is not money for build out of new capacity of rail, certainly not freight rail, what would be considered freight rail, which generally the Alaska Railroad falls into that category. There was money for Amtrak, there was money for inner city passenger rail, but there's not really new money for capacity building of rail. Most of the money that the railroad will get is through increases from the FTA transit formula programs based on their passenger traffic. And I believe that does pass through DOT's budget in a way, and then they split it with actually the Muni of Anchorage. But in terms of new, other than the existing, like the CRISA grant program, there's some existing grant programs that the railroad is eligible for, as they are every year, but not new sources of funding for that type of thing.
Follow up, Senator Wilson, then Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Just on that passenger rail, then, has the administration considered doing a commuter rail for Matsuda Anchorage?
We have not considered that as part of this infrastructure bill. No, sir.
Thank you for that question, Senator Wilson. Senator Wilikowski.
Well, yeah, it was on that point. Are there federal dollars available for, because you said there were no freight dollars, are there commuter dollars that we could take advantage of to explore a commuter line between Anchorage and Matsu, for example?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, there are generally, and I'd be happy to get the railroad to provide a more detailed response, but there are competitive grant programs that the the principal driver of a successful award is based on moving passenger traffic off of roads and individual cars and onto centralized transit. I think in the case of a new passenger rail between Matsu and Anchorage, for example, that sort of new build out of capacity would be a bit challenged in the opportunities in this bill, but it's something that, you know, if the two municipalities and the railroad are interested in exploring, it may be worth looking at.
Mr. Steininger?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, if I could add a little bit to Mr. Baker's answer. If there is money coming into the Alaska Railroad that isn't something that passes through DOT, through FTA grants, you wouldn't see this in this bill because the Alaska Railroad is not actually subject to the Alaska Budget Act. And so you don't see receipts of federal funds in appropriation bills that come before the legislature, as the Alaska Railroad's actually exempt from that process. So if they do receive a direct grant to the Alaska Railroad, you wouldn't see an appropriation bill coming from the Office of Management and Budget.
Okay. I think we're at a point in time. It's at almost 11 o'clock. We're on page 9. We've covered several more pages. Questions are good. We're a little light on backup from the agencies. My staff will work with the administration to set up another meeting to finish these slides, and I would like to encourage that we have the appropriate agencies there to answer the questions and to help you guys out for Lifelines. So with that being said, we're going to adjourn here in a second. This afternoon's meeting's at 1 o'clock. We're gonna have workforce development. We're gonna have industry, Department of Education, University, and Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We are adjourned at 11 a.m.